You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Welcome back to The Spear, the story of the combat experience. I'm Dr. Charlie Fate, your host, and today's guest is author, journalist, and former Army Ranger, Marty Scoveland. Marty, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Charlie. Always a pleasure.
Marty, I've wanted to have you on the show for a long time, and I'm thrilled that we were finally able to align schedules. So for our audience who might not be familiar with you and your work, can you give us a little bit of your origin story? How did you grow up? Where are you from? And what prompted you to join the Army?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from South Dakota, a small rural farm town, an hour from the nearest interstate. And that's where I grew up. And I don't think my story is all that unique in that regard. Lots of people that join the Army from the middle of Iowa, the middle of Kansas, the middle of South Dakota, that sort of thing. But, you know, there's a lot of people that served in the military in my family. Just about every male, I would say, in some capacity, whether that be reserve, guard, active, multiple different branches. My uncle was actively serving. He was a 20-year Air Force, you know, served as a security forces NCO. And so I remember growing up very young and in high school specifically, him calling the family on like Christmas or Thanksgiving when everybody's over to talk to them from Iraq or Kuwait or Saudi Arabia or some of the other places that he went over the years. And so that was all just very sort of influential on me. I think I read a lot too. I was a ferocious reader, and a big part of that was, you know, Tom Clancy books where, you know, you're reading Clear and Present Danger, and that book opens with, you know, LERP type troops out in the jungles of Central America somewhere. And I read a lot of the Vietnam memoirs. I would read about any military content I could get my hands on. Of course, Black Hawk Down and that sort of thing. Watched all the war movies, played with G.I. Joes as a young kid. Like, I was the person that everybody knew was going to go into the military in some capacity or another. You know, what specific path I took was maybe the only thing up in the air. But my dad was in the Army, so was my grandpa. My grandpa served in World War II and was involved in Normandy and all of that. And so I think the Army route was always the one that I defaulted to. And I had, as far as wanting to go the special operations route, I had an uncle who was like a second dad to me. His name is Randy. And he served in NSW in Vietnam. He did two tours in Vietnam. He wasn't a SEAL. He was more of like what I would call, he was a diver and an augmentee and served in the capacity as a SEAL. I don't want to get him in trouble for like stolen valor or anything. He's never said he's a SEAL or anything like that, but he was doing the SEAL mission along with those guys. He was doing raids up and down the Mekong River and things like that. And, you know, so I heard his stories, and I think that's really what turned me onto the idea of like this world of special operations. And I think it's because of movies like Black Hawk Down, and definitely what solidified my choice for wanting to go the Ranger Regiment route was actually the Battle of Tucker Gar, Roberts Ridge, as a lot of people know it. And I still remember, I was in high school when that happened. That was March 4th, 2002. I was in high school still. And I still remember that story on the, you know, front page of USA Today. And they had this big infographic of, you know, where the 47 landed and what the QRF had to do, what the different elements were doing. And that was First Battalion, ACO, 1st Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment. And they did, you know, I would say the lion's share of the fighting that day. That stuck with me. It was like, okay, if I want to do this, this is where it's at, you know. And it's along with, you know, there's the 18 X-ray program for SF. SEALs, you can come in straight off the street. The Ranger Regiment has the shortest pipeline, though, especially back then. It's a longer pipeline now, but back then it was shorter. And it felt like the fastest flash to bang to get me involved in the war, because I was one of those kids that was, and it's hilarious in retrospect, but I was one of those kids that was like, oh man, I don't want to just miss my generation's war. You know, this could end at any day, and, you know, hilarious in retrospect. But, you know, I think that really quick flash to bang as far as, you know, getting through whatever selection process into a unit and then deploying was really appealing to me. And then just the fact that Rangers were, I didn't, you know, compared to what I would find out in that unit versus what I thought they did. Of course, there was a little bit of delta in between there. I wasn't off on, hey, that's where the action's at, it seems. I wasn't wrong about that. That is where the action was. Charlie, you and I worked on a book together that detailed just how involved the Ranger Regiment was throughout the War on Terror. I think even despite that book, they probably still don't get as much credit as they deserve for what they were doing, especially post like 2005, 2006, when they started doing a lot more unilateral mission. That sort of industrialized special operations targeting machine really got spinning, and there was just too much work to go around for just the you know, special mission units. And you know, Ranger Regiment really came into their own. That was the era that I was there. You know, I made it to the Ranger Regiment in the spring of 2006, and I was there through the summer of 2010. And so I was able to get 3 deployments to Iraq, 2 to Afghanistan in during that time. I definitely want to point out that I was not exactly the candidate for best Ranger competition or anything like that. I survived that time. I think especially after I got my footing, after a while I provided value, but I was definitely one of those guys that was just, I came in at 18 years old, relatively sheltered from the world in rural South Dakota, and just really didn't know my head from my tail, especially that first year or so. So I ended up doing a couple of different jobs out there. And, you know, one of the things that I got to do and what got me very interested in the intel world was I started augmenting the technical surveillance folks. And then I kind of took over for our platoon in that role and my last 2 deployments. And that was where I felt I really hit my stride, was doing that role. It kind of combined the more cerebral aspects of war, I would say, that appealed to me, because I am a little bit of a classic overthinker, which is not necessarily good for clearing rooms and doing that sort of stuff. You know, you need to make good decisions, but you shouldn't be overthinking every step of the way. Whereas, you know, using some of the equipment that you use for in the TSE world, it really appealed to me, but I was still able to be out on target and do Ranger things, you know? So it's kind of the best of both worlds for me. And at that point too, like I said, I had a couple deployments under my belt and felt a little bit more comfortable in the environment. So it was a huge, huge coming of age learning experience for me. I think if you talk to some guys that knew me on, say, my first deployment, I'm a totally different person now. And, you know, you do a lot of growing and things like that. And I used to be pretty hard on myself back then too, about some of the mistakes that I made, not realizing like, dude, you're, you know, now that I know as a nearly 40-year-old man, like, dude, you were 18, 19 years old. You didn't know anything. Like, so I give myself a little bit more grace now. Still a few things I'd like to have done differently, but a little bit more grace. But I feel very fortunate that I was able to be in the Ranger Regiment during that specific time period. You know, my first deployment, we did something like 110 missions in 90 days. Like, the op tempo was insane. And I think for a lot of guys now, they would kill to have an op tempo even 10% of that, you know? And so I feel very fortunate in from a historical context of the fact that I got to be in the Ranger Regiment during that time when it was arguably one of the best times to be a Ranger. And it was really, really great. After I left that, you know, I got married between my 4th and 5th deployment, and I think my wife probably wanted, she'd been with me through 4 out of my 5 deployments, and she was graduating college and wanted to get her career started back up in Boston, where near where she's from. She was an interior designer, and you know, you need to be in sort of specific metropolitan areas to kick that sort of career off. And I wasn't ready to get out yet. I had ambitions set toward a you know, through the TSE work, I'd been exposed to this other unit that exists. And that was, you know, I was never the guy that was going to go to the Fort Bragg Special Missions Unit. That was not who I was, as I talked about. But there was this other Special Missions Unit that I felt very drawn to and knew a few people that had gone that route. And it seemed like, oh my gosh, this is a way for me to do everything I've ever wanted to do and work that I really enjoyed. But I'm not ready right this second. My wife wants to go get her career started. I feel like I owe her. And so I decided to do the one thing that you can do in the Army and go literally anywhere in the country, right? I did some research and was like, oh, I could volunteer to go be a recruiter. And I'd read that if you volunteer to be a recruiter, you can pick whatever station in the country you want to go to. Turns out that's partially true. They actually don't get any more specific than the brigade, which is a large swath of America. Yeah, that was something. So we didn't end up in, you know, so I volunteered for that with the intention of I'm going to go do 3 years as a recruiter. And I'd actually talked to VAU Charlie, a squadron commander from that unit that I eventually wanted to get to at one of our get togethers in Yale. And he told me that, hey, yeah, your experience as a recruiter and your experience doing direct action, the Range Rider, is going to make you a very unique candidate and set you apart from all the other guys that have just direct action, because you're out working with just you or you and a few other guys in an office completely estranged from a military base and all that infrastructure. Of course, it's not the same. And you have to build relationships in the community. You have to do a lot of this soft skill sort of development. And he's like, that's going to be, you know, you combine that with the fact that you know how to build a charge and things like that. It's like, that makes you somebody that will stand out when we're thinking about who to bring on the team. And so that really motivated me. I went out there and tried to be the best recruiter that I was. And it's funny, I think that's how we literally met Charlie, was through a message board, because I was trying to find out. I was like, I can't just go. I was going to reclass from 11 Bravo to a 35 Papa crypto linguist, and then the goal would be to go to that unit. But I was like, rationally, if I'm going to switch MOSs, I need to learn that MOS. So why don't I, you know, I read up on SOD A's in group. And I was like, that would be a great place to go to just learn the job of a 35 Papa and learn the foundations of that job. And it's still in the world of special operations. Do that for 2 or 3 years and then put in my packet to go to that other unit and try my hand at that, you know? And so that was the whole plan. And that was, you know, so I was up there in central New York, 5 hours from Boston, you know, doing the recruiting thing. And I was pretty successful at that. It's easy to sell kids on the Army when you can just, you know, you've got a tan beret hanging on the wall and cool guy pictures and stuff like that. So that's what I did, you know. And as it got closer to the end of that time, I took the D-Lab. I absolutely crushed the D-Lab. I was very excited about that. I qualified for any language I wanted to do, all of that. And my wife started looking at apartments out in Monterey. And you know what I mean? Like, we were starting to plan for this next phase of my military career. Well, around that time, you know, being a couple of years removed from battalion at that point, 2 years or so. And, you know, my company specifically, Seco 175, suffered the most casualties in the war on terror in the deployment after I left. And, you know, I have no sort of egotistical ideas about, oh, if I had just been there, they'd still be alive today. No, nothing like that. It's, I should have been there to at least pitch in, to pull a CQ shift for somebody who's mourning their friend or their soldier, to make sure the coffee's filled, to do anything, to jump in and fill a spot for somebody that needs, you know what I mean? Like, it was that feeling of like, I am not there when I could be contributing in some way. And instead I'm sitting out here in rural central New York talking to Billy and his mom about how to be a wheeled vehicle mechanic in the reserves, you know, like and of course the more mature version of me is, hey, recruiting is an important job. It's a very important job, but, that was hard. And so you get a little bit nostalgic at times. And there was one night I was sitting at my house And I'd already taken the D-Lab and all that stuff, but I have this recurring memory. It was from my fourth deployment. My fourth deployment was to Iraq. It was the end of 2008 into the beginning of 2009. What happened during that? That was when the SOFA, the Status of Forces Agreement, was signed, and Iraq was winding down, and sort of the military was shifting to Afghanistan. Well, that was true also for the majority of the special operations forces that had traditionally been deploying to Iraq were now shifting to Afghanistan. What that meant for us, our platoon was one of the platoons got tapped. We were the half asset, the helicopter assault force asset for the entire country of Iraq, that deployment. It was awesome. And we weren't sort of, you know, Range regiments never owned battle space, but we typically had a geographical area that we were roughly responsible for. On this deployment, it was the entire country of Iraq. We'd be in Baghdad one night, Mosul the next night, Al Qaim the next. It was awesome. And every single night, landed on the X or landed on the Y, or doing a offset and, you know, of 2 or 3 kilometers, nothing crazy. And just, it was peak, like, holy shit. Sorry if there's no cussing on this one. This is a little bit more of a professional podcast. I'll catch myself. But it was like, holy moly, this is one of the greatest opportunities you can have as a Ranger. And I remember I had this recurring memory that stuck in my head from that deployment. I can't remember, it wasn't some specific mission, but it was just this moment that I had in the ready room where we're all in there getting ready for the mission. And for whatever reason, I just had this moment of real presence where I looked around the room and just realized how lucky I was to be a part of this and to be among these men. And as everybody's jocking up, doing radio checks, things like that. And that was a great platoon, that deployment. That the platoon sergeant was the future regimental sergeant major, who is now the sergeant major of the, I think he just left the 10th Mountain Division. Command Sergeant Major Brett Johnson was the platoon sergeant that deployment. Amazing. He will be in the Ranger Hall of Fame, no doubt. Amazing leader. You know, we had squad leaders with 6-7 deployments under their belts. We had E6 team leaders in some cases because the platoon just had such great retention and was so stacked that there was guys that were getting promoted before there was a position ready for them. I mean, even there might have been only one or two guys out of that entire platoon that was their first deployment. Even a lot of the privates, that was their second pump. And we were just so good on target, so good. And so that moment in the ready room stuck with me, and my mind would drift back there sometimes, you know, long drives or on a walk, or, you know, your mind drifts to some of these little snapshots. And, you know, one night I'm sitting on my couch, it's like 2012, I think I'm 2 years into my recruiting tour, getting ready to go do this reclass after my recruiting tour ends in a year. And I'm sitting there, I think I'm like 4 beers into a 6-pack, and decide to, you know, let me just get this out of my head and down on paper. This is before I knew I wanted to be a writer or a journalist, an author, any of that. I just wanted to get this thing that was in my head down on paper. And so I wrote it down, and it was just this description of that memory that I have. And I just focused on one guy that was getting ready, and I was extremely detailed, and I just called it the Ranger, and I posted it online, and it very quickly caught steam all over the place. And at first I didn't take credit for it. I wasn't trying to be a writer, an author, and make a name for myself at all. I mean, I saw it aspirations of going to a special missions unit, you know, but it really got over the place. And before I knew it, I had people asking about, hey, can you put this on like a poster or a t-shirt or something like that? And I was like, well, you know, me and Lauren were in the middle of a bathroom renovation at that time. I was like, you know, maybe pay for the tile or something if I put this up. Well, I put a few things up. I sold prints of that, what I wrote down on, and a t-shirt, and it took off. Absolutely took off. And so my last, I don't know, 6-9 months in the military, I was running this little company called Blackside. It was going well enough that I kind of thought to myself, I was still wanted to stay in the military, but I was like, this is going so well. I'm a recruiter. I know how to get back in. Maybe I should get out and kind of see this through. What do you do when you start a business, right? Again, I still don't know. I want to be a writer or anything like that. But what do you do when you start a business? You're like, I got to market this thing. What do I do? I need to make YouTube videos. We did that. And we got to start a blog. So we started this thing called Hit the Woodline. And it was all satire. And then we started the Havoc Journal, which was a lot of like essays and op-eds and things like that. I mean, it was a place that we could throw everything from poetry to short stories to real spicy hot takes on, and it was really, really cool. And then we also worked on a book together that was born out of sort of just, again, not even trying to be an author at that point. It was like, we need to go tell these stories. We're in a position to do this. Let's go do that. And so we collected a bunch of stories from Rangers to kind of tell the story from a human perspective of the first 10 years in the Ranger Regiment. We called that Violence of Action, the Untold Stories of the 75th Ranger Regiment in the War on Terror. And it was through all that process, the blogging, the working on the book, all that, that I was like, I think that my passion is not necessarily being an entrepreneur or business ownership. I think it's telling stories. I really, really enjoy this. And so we kind of split up the company a little bit, and I moved into a van with my wife, and we started traveling the country. I started pitching different outlets, trying to get my name out there as a writer, get writing assignments, things like that, starting to do a little bit of journalism. We did that for about 10 months, and it was an amazing trip. And with that trip was cut short. We planned to do a full year, but it was cut short because we found out my dad had ALS. So we kind of booked it home to South Dakota to be there. And once I got there, I was there to, be with my dad until, thing about ALS is there's no light at the end of the tunnel. Like, it is, you will die from this. It's a matter of when, not if. There's no cure for it. So, we were going to be there until he passed, and be there to help and all that. During that time, I continued to get more and more writing assignments. I also got booked to co-star on a History Channel show called JFK Declassified, which exposed me to the world of like running a show and filmmaking and production and what a professional production actually looks like. And so that exposed me to all that. And my dad died in August 2017. And a month or two later, we moved out to New Hampshire to be closer to Lauren's, my wife's parents. And then it was a couple months later, I started at Black Rifle Coffee. They needed somebody to start a blog for them. In my typical fashion, I was not satisfied with just starting a blog. I needed to completely blow it out of proportion, which I did. I ran Coffee or Die magazine, built that from the ground up. It started as just me. And then by the time I left Black Rifle the first time in 2022, it had 24 employees. We'd started other publications. I had 32 people total. We were sending people around the world, reporting from war zones. We had one of the largest presences, journalistic presences in Ukraine within weeks of Russia invading in 2022. It was an amazing, amazing journey. And then from there, I took a job as the editor-in-chief at Task and Purpose. I did that for a year and a half. And then Black Rifle asked me to come back as the VP of social and strategy. And so I took that opportunity, and I was there for about a year. And then I left that last summer and started my own podcasts, and I'm working on a few books right now. Oh, along the way, I wrote a book called Send Me, The True Story of a Mother at War. It's about Shannon Kent, a senior chief petty officer, Shannon Kent. And today, that we're recording this on January 16th, 2026. Today is actually the 7-year anniversary of her and three other Americans being killed in action in Manbij, Syria. And, so that opportunity came up, and it's been optioned for film. And so I've just got all this inertia that has led me to this point right now. And, I don't know, that's kind of the long-winded, but as quick as I could tell it, genesis of Marty Scoblin Jr. from birth to 2026.
Well, Marty, that was a great intro, and you've done some very interesting things and wide-ranging things, from being a ranger to being an author and being on TV and many more things to come, I'm sure. I'd like to go back to something that you mentioned about your time being in the Ranger Regiment. You mentioned that you did a total of 5 deployments, mm-hmm. if I added that up correctly, 3 in Iraq and 2 in Afghanistan. And yep. The time that you were in that unit, was that a lot of deployments?
I think it was about average for somebody that had been there for 4 or 5 years. That was probably about average. Some people would maybe miss a deployment in there because of going to Ranger school or an injury or something like that. But yeah, if you were there for a full enlistment, you could expect to do somewhere between 3 and 5 deployments, just depending on when exactly you got there in the jort cycle and when you left, but 3 to 5 was probably typical. And so I ended up on the high side of that.
So I'd like to focus our conversation on your deployments and the leadership lessons that you learned from those, and how they might apply to junior and aspiring leaders. So were there any events specifically in any of your deployments that jump out to you as things that you think are particularly memorable?
Yeah, and I'm going to try to narrow this down to things that have a leadership angle to it. I would say there's not like a specific mission where I want to really highlight specific leadership, but it was more, I'll give Brett Johnson a lot of credit. That fourth deployment, I thought he was a fantastic leader. He saw value in a lot of different people and really was great at recognizing talent and matching people with what they were good at and then had them do that. You know, it almost felt like he was doing a little bit of Moneyball as far as how he constructed a manifest. He had, you know, the Ranger Regiment, especially at that time, was known for strict adherence to standards as far as uniform standards and things like that. They still strictly adhere to standards, but I think that they've loosened up a little bit on certain things about how you know, as far as like, hey, tailor it to the mission. There's not just one blanket SOP, I don't think. But at the time, the Ranger Regiment was still pretty known for that. And he was very open to, if I ask you why you did a thing, as long as you have a reasonable why behind why you made that choice and not just it look cool or whatever, then I have no problem. And he really did stick to that. And I think it gave a lot of autonomy to a lot of people in that platoon and in that strike force. He was a very mature leader. And we got to do a lot of cool things. And I really respect him as a platoon sergeant at that time, and the fact that he was still very much jumping in the stack, getting into the fight, helping out where needed, and all of that. And I think he's probably one of the few, I think as a battalion sergeant major, he received a Silver Star because he jumped into the middle of something. That's pretty rare.
Wow.
So I look at him as an exceptional leader. There's another person that comes to mind that I don't believe it would be appropriate to say their name because of where they currently work, but this particular person was a squad leader and then a weapons squad leader before they went off to do other things. And I specifically remember, so he'd gone to selection for this other unit and then was waiting for his training class to start. And there's a gap in between there. A lot of guys, when they get selected for this other unit, they'll come back and they'll kind of be mailing it in. They'll be their minds on getting ready for that training course, you know, doing their own PT, being a little bit on their own program. He came back and he felt like he owed it to the unit that he had made it and, or made it, you know, owed to the, you know, Ranger Regiment. And I remember, I feel like he went even harder during that time. I remember there were nights that I was leaving work and he was out there in the COF right there with his weapon squad doing crew drills and stuff with them, until 5, 6, 7 o'clock at night on like a P2 day where everybody kind of took off at 2 or 3 o'clock, you know? And he cared about the boys. He cared so much and he wanted them prepared for war. He wanted them ready. He was again, another reasonable person, but don't piss the guy off, you know? He was just one of those exceptional people. And I really look at him as the example of what leadership looks like. And then there's another one, and this is another training one, I guess, but Martin Lugo, who was killed in Afghanistan in 2010. I remember when he became a squad leader. Yeah, I was leaving for lunch one day, walking from our company area to the parking lot. And this was like summer, Savannah, Georgia, hot as all get out. Middle of the afternoon, you know, just gross out there. And as I'm walking to the parking lot, I see Lugo round the corner out the back end of the COF and onto this main road right there with his squad in tow. He's got these guys in like full kit, you know, uniform bottoms and boots, but a PT shirt on, you know, recognizing how hot it was, weapons drawn, everything, taking them out on a kit run. And, when I got back from lunch, I remember him saying, you know, we like to say we train like we fight, but if you're not taking your guys out to go do PT in the middle of the afternoon sun, then you're not getting them ready for where we're going. And that just really like talk about making the, it's too easy for a leader to just be like, hey guys, see you after lunch, you know, or it's too hot out right now. I don't want to risk a heat casualty or something like that. And I'm not saying you know, for young leaders out there not to use common sense and do your risk mitigation, of course. But I just really, really respected that. You know, and he didn't tell his guys to go out there. He was leading. And so those are some things that I think about. The other stuff, you know, when you think about deployments and things like that, everybody's just doing their job and doing it typically at a very high level. And you feed off of each other, I think, a little bit. And you don't want to be the slow guy or the guy that doesn't know what he's doing. Or you're not going to bat 1,000. I certainly didn't. But it's that competitive environment and everybody's a professional. You want to go get the bad guy. You want to get jackpot and all that sort of stuff. And it just... seeing the way the different NCOs conducted themselves through numerous deployments was something that really rubbed off on me. I wouldn't be the person that I am today if it wasn't for the influence of those men that I was standing shoulder to shoulder with for, you know, four and a half years.
So Marty, you mentioned doing HAFs, helicopter assault force missions. For our listeners who aren't familiar with that, can you describe what that is? What does that look like in combat?
Man, would I love to do that, because they are my favorite things in the world. I still, to this day, one of my favorite things about being in the Army was riding in helicopters. I absolutely loved it. And so basically, there's actually three different methods that the Ranger Regiment, and I would call it widely the special operations community, use to get to work, to get to a target. You've got HAFs, which are a helicopter assault force. You've got GAFs, which are ground assault force, where you're using vehicles over the ground and you're driving there. And then you've got BAFs, which are fairly rare, but I actually have seen it happen a few times. And those are called boat assault forces, where you're using a rigid hull or something like that. Typically, the SWCC guys are driving those. And so those are that. The two most common, though, are the HAFs and the GAFs. And that was the question every night, especially my first deployment. Are we HAFing or are we GAFing? You know, that was the question every night. And, you know, HAFs are always the funnest because you're flying in a helicopter, and what that kind of looks like, whether it's a very planned out mission or a time sensitive target, you know, you get your kit on, you either walk out to the flight line or you get driven out to the flight line, depending on what outstation you were at and what that place was set up like. You know, my first deployment where we were at the MSS in Baghdad there, we literally just walked 50 yards and there's all the birds, you know. It was great. You didn't have to be driven anywhere. You know, Salerno, we had to be driven around over to the flight line, over where the birds were at. And so you do that, you do a manifest call, make sure everybody's good to go. You'll load the bird. I can still feel the heat off of 47 exhaust on my skin to this day. I can smell that. I can still feel the butterflies of, you know, walking up to a little bird or getting snapping in with my feet dangling out on a Blackhawk, and that little, as soon as it leaves the ground, that little wobble that happens where you realize you are not tethered to the ground anymore. Just those feelings that make it really, really special. And then particularly, you know, you're an alumni of the 160th, and they were, I would call it 9 times out of 10, the guys that were flying us on HAFs. There was some exceptions, but 9 times out of 10, it was those guys. And they're the best in the world at what they do, the best in the world. And so you're flying fast, you're flying accurately, and there's a couple of different ways that you can land on a target. You can land what's called landing right on the X, and where you're literally landing on the building or fast roping into the courtyard or right outside of the building, but you're right there. You're right into it. There's the Y, which is a couple hundred yards off, and then it's like a sprint where one or two people will always eat shit. And I got to quit cussing. But it's a sprint to the target, but you're right there. You can see it. It's within eyesight. And then there's what's called offsets, where you might walk anywhere from 2 kilometers to, in Afghanistan, we had some 15, 16, 17 kilometer infills. And so those can all do that once you get off the helicopter. Obviously, the most exciting are landing on the X or the Y. Those are the ones that everybody gets real excited for because you're just right into the action. And there's one memorable one that we did where it was that fourth deployment that I did. And we were doing a half, but it was all the way out in Al Kain, and we were based out of Balad. And so that's about 3 hours of flying to get out there, give or take. And we had to do a refueling along the way and everything. Yeah, this was December. Yes, it gets hot, cold in Iraq in December, especially if you're riding in that back right seat in a Blackhawk with the doors not on yet because the flight crews haven't put the doors on yet because it just got cold that week. I mean, that long ride out there, and we were landing on the X for that one. that long ride out there, I had like, it was so cold. I had snot frozen all across the side of my face from riding in that back right seat right there where you're just taking the wind the entire time and it's cold. And I remember as we were coming in, getting ready, you're waiting, you've got your hand on your safety line that's tethering you to the floor of the helicopter. And the, you know, one thing that got reinforced on Talker Gar back in 2002 is don't unclip until you feel that little bounce from the helicopter landing, knowing that you have hit solid ground. Because sometimes when they come to a hover, you can feel like you're on the ground and there's a brownout, so you can't see the ground. You don't want to make that mistake of thinking it's time to get out of the helicopter when you're still 20 feet off the ground. So you're waiting for that bump and you're just about ready. And then it's coming in and, you know, they come in fast when you're landing on the X like that. So we're coming in fast and you're waiting for a good little bounce when they hit. And then all of a sudden I just felt the helicopter pull up really hard and like almost to the point where you are like, it almost puts you on your butt. You know, I was on a knee, so it was like physically impossible and you're packed in there, but it was like that gravity, that pressure, you know, against the floor became really great. And they start circling around. And then, the crew chief let us know over the radio that, there was wires they couldn't see there. At first I thought we were taking fire or something and I just didn't hear it, or that maybe they saw a dude on a roof with a RPG or something. That was my assumption of such a dramatic change of course there as we were about to land. It actually was because they saw power lines at the very last second that they couldn't see from ISR. And so that was the pull-up. So we end up having to circle around, land a block at an intersection a block away. So turned into landing on the exit more of a Y and then sprinting up that block to get there. And that was, you know, that was one of those days that was exciting. There was another one in Afghanistan that kind of sticks out to me because we weren't flying with 160th. We were using conventional birds. The way it worked in Afghanistan at that time, you could probably speak better to this than me, but the entire task force would have, there's only so many 160th birds go around, and every strike force within the task force, it was kind of first come, first served for those helicopters, those 160th helicopters. Let's just say there was 5 strike forces around the country. I don't remember or even know the real number that was back then. It's not relevant, but let's just say there was 5, but there's only 4 groups of helicopters to ferry guys around. If your mission pops last that night and you're the 5th one and everybody else has already spoken for, what you have to do, because you're still going to go do the mission, you walk down the road to whatever the conventional aviation brigade that's at the airfield that you're at. Rangers are almost always stationed at airfields, and ask them, hey, do you want to go fly for, you know, the varsity team tonight? We weren't the varsity team. We were like the JV team, but, you know, we felt like we were the varsity team. And they would always, of course, be very excited. You know, you'd probably, a lot of those pilots are probably wanting to go the 160th route one day, and that's a good bullet on the OER, the NCOER that you flew for the task force and all that other stuff. And so we set that all up, and it's not a terribly complicated thing. It's a long offset. They're going to drop us off like 8 kilometers from the target building, landing in, you know, basically an open field out in coasts there. One of those just wide open sort of arid desert sort of looking places, just rocks everywhere, you know? And so we load up, we get on these, and you can tell the difference between the birds. And this is not to like be derogatory towards conventional birds or anything like that. There's some amazing heroic things that have happened over the years. You don't need to just like, as a soldier, you don't need to be in the Ranger Regiment or some tier one unit to do great things in combat. Same is true for helicopters, right? And those crews. But on this particular one, the pilot was, I think, feeling a little bit too night stalkerish that night, not realizing that it is not just a skills gap between 160th crews and conventional crews. It is also an equipment gap. The 160th has the premier instruments and other things on it, and is equipped to do things like these really quick, you know, flare at the last second and set it down. This crew tried to do that. Thank goodness we weren't landing on the X or anything. Like I said, very offset, but this is a very rocky field. They tried to do the come in fast and flare at the last second, which was totally unneeded because, again, we weren't like, just set it down nice and easy. We got a long walk ahead, you know. They wanted to do the really cool guy thing. What they ended up doing was cutting it a little bit too close to the ground. So they ripped the wheels off, damage the back end of the bird. We kind of, I call it a crash landing. I think it was probably the kindest crash landing you could have. It like put you on your butt. You felt it, but it was not. There's guys you talk to that have been real crash landings and they have issues for the rest of their lives. You know, they might not walk right again. This was not that. This was more of just a, man, that was an extremely rough landing. And then the back ramp wouldn't open up. So we had to, or wouldn't open up all the way. So we had to kind of like climb up it and then drop down from the other side to get out and all that other stuff. Different group picked us up on the way back out. And when we got back to the airfield, that 47 was sitting on mattresses back on Salerno. So that one kind of sticks out too. But yeah, halves are the funnest thing that you do. I can't think of a more fun way to get to target unless you're one of the rare humans that's like haloed into a, you know, combat zone or something. I'm sure that's even cooler, but like helicopter assault is by far, it was one of my favorite things. I looked forward to it. It's the thing that I miss the most about every time that I've gone out and embedded with Special Operations Forces as a journalist. It's always like, when do we get to do the helicopters? I always bring a safety. I still have my old safety line and my old riggers belt with me. I always bring it just in case they'll let me ride in the door as a civilian and, you know, let me relive my glory days a little bit. Occasionally they do.
Well, Marty, I'm just picturing this CH-47 basically up on blocks back on the airfield because it ripped off its landing gear. That's a pretty funny image.
Yeah, it was first and only time I've had very good luck with helicopters. First and only time I was in anything even remotely approaching a sort of crash landing like that.
You spent time in both Afghanistan and Iraq from an operations perspective as an infantryman, as a ranger. Did you have a preference for one theater over another?
Yeah, you know, they were both unique. And I think there's pros and cons to each, but I would say I probably preferred Iraq, just because it was much more of an urban sort of fight and it was very interesting. And we're in all these like very, I remember like, you know, going and doing this mission in Old Town Mosul, and it's just, you feel like you're in this ancient place, you know, like you're walking the same ground as probably Roman soldiers, you know, dead in the same, along the same courtyard walls and stuff that are built with just these ancient bricks. And, you know, so I thought Iraq was really cool from that perspective. Also, typically the op tempo was a lot higher in Iraq than it was in Afghanistan. So for that reason too, you were busier. And, yeah, so I think I probably preferred Iraq. But Afghanistan was very interesting from the perspective of, you're up in the mountains, you're going up at altitude. It's a different sort of challenge. You're doing these long walks that I didn't always appreciate at the time, but, you know, it was a different sort of thing. And you're not really in the, for the most part, not in urban environments. You're going to some farmhouse out in the middle of nowhere. And, I would say though, it felt like the danger was higher in Afghanistan than it was in Iraq. Like, gosh, I remember there was one specific night we were going out and we were doing about, again, it was probably 8, 9, 10, something like that, kilometer offset. And I can't remember if it was either Paktika or Paktia. I can never remember the difference between the two, but it was one of those two provinces and it was in a specific district that Americans hadn't been in since like 2007. And it was supposed to just be absolutely littered with Haqqani network guys and things like that. And so we were, you know, kind of told that, hey, load for bear on this one. We might take contact en route to the target and all that sort of stuff. Well, as we were, before we'd even landed, we were getting ICOM chatter of like the Americans, or they could hear the helicopters. The Americans are coming, you know, basically telling everybody like, get your stuff and let's go, you know? And so that was before we even landed. So it was like one of those nights where like, oh man, this is going to be one of those, you know, a night. And and we ended up walking in. Fortunately, yeah, we did technically make contact, not so much for us, but for them. There was a little PKM nest with a group of homies that didn't make it through the night. We kind of continued on to the target building and all of that. But it was like this old, the target building itself was like this old castle, like medieval castle up on a ridge. And like this hill, it was like almost like, you know, a castle on a mountain sort of vibe. And that last, you know, quarter mile was brutal because you're going straight, like hands and knees at some points, because it's that steep to get up to this thing. And so Afghanistan was unique from that perspective of like old world buildings just felt very, again, you know, Iraq, you think like the Romans or something like that, or the Crusaders or something, you know, in Afghanistan, it's like, oh, Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, like they, that's whose ground you're walking here. It's very, very old, much more rural, more farms and, you know, things like that. And so I think it was interesting, but yeah, just things like that where it felt a little bit more dangerous. I mean, it's not that Iraq wasn't dangerous, and plenty of guys have the proof to show that Iraq wasn't safe. But Afghanistan, to me, it felt like more seasoned fighters there too.
I
think that felt, yeah, that's what I'd say about that.
So you survived all five deployments intact, no more holes than you left. Okay. But if I remember correctly, you had an experience in basic training that got a little spicy.
Yeah, my first year in the Army was full of it was like Murphy's Law. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong. I was shot in the sixth week of basic training at Fort Benning there. And so I had to go on con leave and heal up and come back. And so that kind of interrupted the normal flow of initial entry training for me. Went to airborne school. I got food poisoning from the airborne defect on my second day, threw up all over that sand pit that they put you in one morning. And so I had to sit out the rest of that week, and they just rolled me back the next week, you know, to the next week. And excuse me. And then I made it to RIP, now RASP, Ranger Assessment and Selection Program. This was the 4-week RIP program, Ranger Indoctrination Program. Went to that. And while I was in pre-RIP, I actually had a cousin die. That uncle that I told you about that was in the Air Force for a whole career, it was his daughter. And she was like a sister to us, because when he would go on deployments, you know, mom and the kids would come and stay in our town, and they would be at our house every single day. They were like, you know, his kids were like siblings to us. They were our cousins, but they were like siblings. And she, unfortunately, while I was in pre-RIP, I got the message that she'd hit black ice in North Dakota, rolled, and didn't make it. And so I had to go on FMLA there and go back for that funeral and be there. And so that set me back a little bit there. Get back down to Fort Benning, start RIP, make it all the way through to the end there, just about. And then I fall off the fast rope tower like a day or two before you're supposed to graduate. On that one, the NCO gave me the choice of, he's like, look, dude, I know you're hurting. And I did. I fell about 35 feet off the fast rope tower behind Peden Field there, for the listeners that are familiar. And he was like, it's, you know, it's up to you, but like, and I totally get it, if you know, but you've got two more ropes. I won't make you put combat equipment on or anything like that if you want to do it, but if you don't get five total ropes, that was my third one that I fell on. No, it was my fourth one. I had one left. It was my fourth one. He's like, if you don't get the five, I can't graduate you. And, you know, after you heal up, you'll be a day one restart. And I was just like, man, I already feel like I was lucky just getting to this point, like I'm about to graduate. And so I just kind of put my big boy pants on, hobbled back up the tower and went down for that last time. And that got me a lot of goodwill from the cadre there, because that's how I ended up at First Ranger Battalion. That's where everybody wants to go, almost every, unless you live, you know, you grew up on the West Coast, then you kind of want to go to 275. And unless you joined the Army because your dad was in the Army and you grew up in Phoenix City or Columbus, Georgia, those are the only people that really want to go to 375. Pretty much 90% of guys going through RIP at the time want to go to 175 because it's the beach, it's Savannah, there's college girls, all that. And so there's always more guys that want to go there than get to go there. I was one of the few that got to go to 175 because the NCO from 175 that was deciding who was going to go to his old battalion was like, oh, yeah, you're legit. You know, saw what I did at the fast rope tower the other day and was like, yeah, you earned that. You're going to 175. So it was really cool. That little decision by him changes the trajectory and the course of my life, because I go to Savannah. That's where I meet my wife. That's where I mean, everything, you know, and that little decision. So my first, like I said, 9-10 months or so in the military was fraught with misadventure.
Barty, you've been out for quite a while. You're a very accomplished author, journalist, entrepreneur. You mentioned the book that you co-authored called Send Me. Can you give us a brief synopsis of that and explain the significance of it to our audience?
Absolutely. So Senior Chief Petty Officer Shannon Kent, it's a book about her. And the reason we're even able to write a book about her is because today, when we're recording this 7 years ago, she, alongside three other Americans were, and many, many Syrians, were killed in a ISIS suicide bombing in Manbij, Syria. Back then, and that was January 16th, 2019, about a week later, you know, of course, I, like everybody else, saw it on the news. I was running Coffee or Die at the time, so it was a, you know, thing we were tracking. And I remember seeing the group of people. It was, you've got this Navy cryptologist, a civilian interpreter, a former Navy SEAL turned like DOS contractor or whatever, and then a special forces warrant officer. I'm like, this is an interesting group. And the initial news reports were like, oh, they were out to lunch in Manbij at a popular spot for Americans. And I'm like, I don't know if this was the like go to lunch hangout crowd. I don't, like, you know, and I didn't know for sure, but like, I just, my spidey sense was going off, you know, of like, I don't think that's what these particular group of people were up to. And so that happened. It was probably a week after the bombing, though. 10 days, I don't know, something very shortly after. Evan Hafer, who is the founder of Black Rifle Coffee, he's also a former Green Beret and CIA guy, and Joe Kent, Shannon Kent's husband, who is currently in Ground Branch at the time, former SF guy, former 275 guy, former Special Mission Unit guy, you know, he ticked every box out there, but he was actually just come back from a deployment on emergency as part of Ground Branch because his wife was killed in Syria. And he was not happy about the way her death and the death of those guys was being characterized in the news and wanted the story told. And of course, he had a lot of other reporters reaching out to them from all the big national outlets, but he wanted somebody that got that world, you know, came from that community. And so he wanted to get a hold of me. And apparently Shannon had read some of my work. He says he remembers Shannon sending her my Valley Boy story I did when I embedded with a first group dive team, because Joe was a dive team guy when he was in group. And so she'd read my work and stuff. So he was reaching out because he wanted somebody that got that. And so Evan connected us, and he's like, yeah, I'd just love to have you write a story. And I was like, man, I'd love to do the story justice. And I still didn't know everything at that point. I thought at that point, maybe wrongly so, I was like, yeah, she definitely wasn't the going after large crowd, but I thought it was like sort of the typical intel enabler attached to, you know, do intel stuff. And that wasn't completely accurate. And so Joe invited me down to Maryland there to go to the memorial service that they were going to do. Come to find out, she was the first enlisted sailor ever in the Naval Academy's history to allow an enlisted sailor to have their memorial service at the Naval Academy's chapel. And in fact, the last person to have their funeral there or memorial there was Senator John McCain. So very prestigious thing there. And that's kind of first like, oh, I don't think they do this just for anybody that's killed in action, unfortunately. You know, I get there and I know Joe's a super secret squirrely guy and all that sort of stuff. And when I went down to do that story, actually, I took photos and stuff, but I didn't show his face or anything like that, because he still was technically in Ground Branch. He hadn't had his cover rolled back or anything like that yet, so it was still kind of sensitive. And I go to this memorial. I got special permission to be media there at the request of the family, because of the people attending that memorial there, it was very closed to the public. And for me to be able to be allowed in there with a camera was like kind of a big deal, but there was some trust there because of my background and all of that. And so I went and did that. And as I'm doing the memorial and seeing who's there, and then the different events and things like that, that were before and after that, were the different meet and greets and things like that. Like, they had a thing at the officers club there on the Annapolis and all that. And I'm talking to these people, Charlie, this is like a who's who of the special operations and intelligence community. And I'm talking like the tip of the spear type folks, people that you don't know exist, that you assume exist out there. That's who's here. It's a who's who of that. I mean, I specifically remember talking to one guy. I don't know his name, but we talked for like 5 minutes, and he'd just gotten out of an African prison that he had to figure his way out of. You know, that's the sort of people that were there. And they, Charlie, every one of these people that I talked to, and there's a few people that I knew there and I knew where they worked, so I was like, oh, and you're here. And every one of them said, no, Shannon, like, We literally are less capable today because she is not with us anymore. It's not even just it's a sad, we lost one of the good ones. It was, no, this is, she was like a capability. And all of these guys just glowed about her. I talked to, I don't even want to say position, but somebody that would be in the know of how she performed in selection for the unit that she went to. And he said, I've been doing this for a long time. I've seen a lot of people come through. You almost never know that somebody's going to make it until right at the very end. With Shannon, we knew almost immediately. He's like, she is probably the only person I ever knew right from the get-go because she was that freaking good. By the end of that night, you know, after the memorial and all these different things, and then he ended up at this like bar in DC there where all the family and her friends and stuff go to, and I had a few drinks and stuff, and I remember I just couldn't get around. I was like, this is more than just a article for Coffee or Die. This is more than just a magazine article. This deserves some real estate. This is clearly an incredible person. And even then, even at that point, I still didn't know exactly how incredible, but I had a pretty good idea that this was not your average Intel enabler, even in special operations. And so I remember telling Joe that night, I was like, you know, you're going to be hit up by every other reporter that wants to write a book on her. All I want to say is just consider my hat thrown in the ring. And he was smartly, very noncommittal. He's like, yeah, man, that would be, you know, let's see how things go. And I think he wanted to, Joe, to his credit, very smart guy. He's currently the director of the National Counterterrorism Center. I think probably wanted to see how all the different articles that were going to be written about her turned out. You know, when I wrote mine, it came out right around Mother's Day. So a couple months later, it was a big, like 5,000-6,000 word behemoth. I think I wrote the longest article out of everybody, but I got immediate feedback from him and the family of, this is the best thing written on Shannon. We're so happy with this. You nailed it. And let's start talking book. And so we did. And Joe had already had a literary agent reach out to him. That is now Larry, who's now my literary agent. And we got connected, got it going. And, you know, 6 months later, we had a book proposal put together, sold it to HarperCollins, William Morrow at HarperCollins, and started the long process of trying to write a book about a woman whose entire life was classified. Took about 4 years.
Well, I've read it. I think it's great. Highly recommend that book for aspiring professionals, not only soft professionals, but anyone interested in Intel or the Joint Force. I think they'd get a lot out of it. A lot of lessons learned in there from the leadership perspective as well, because on top of everything else that she did, linguist, cryptologist, a special operator, she was also a leader as well. Humaner, all of the things. Yep. Total package on that, for sure. Well, Marty, what are you up to these days? What kind of things are you into now?
So I run my own podcast, Subject Matter Expert. I think this, if you like this podcast, I think that you might like Subject Matter Expert. Charlie's been a guest on it, and I try to get people that, you know what they're really talking about. You know, it's not, I try not to turn it into something where I'm just grabbing random people and we just sit there and opine on random different things for 2 hours. I try to get people that really know what they're talking about and have some expertise in an area. Sometimes it's real serious subjects like conflict reporting or, you know, special operations intelligence with you, Charlie. I've also had more lighthearted ones on there where, like, I had somebody on there that was on multiple seasons of Naked and Afraid, you know, talking about survival. It was a really interesting conversation, but it's, you know, there's not one specific niche. It's not just military or veteran stuff. It's, I try to really go broad with the type of guests that I have on there. As long as it's interesting to me, I figure it must be interesting to somebody else out there. So I'd love to encourage everybody to check that out. That's kind of one of the big things I'm working on. I'm also working on a book about rucking with Jason McCarthy at Go Ruck. I know he's come up to West Point there more than a few times, and there's probably been some Go Ruck events up there. And so we're working on that together. I'm very excited about that. And I am just, you know, one foot in front of the other, trying to do my best out there, just like everybody else.
Marty, I really appreciate your time today. I've got one more final question for you. You've been a leader for many years in business and in the military. You've been around a lot of great leaders. What advice do you have for current and aspiring leaders?
It's impossible for me to narrow that down to just one thing, but I'll quickly ramble off like attributes that I think that every good leader has. You have to be humble. It doesn't mean you can't have an ego. And I think in a lot of positions, it's healthy to have a healthy ego and to believe that you're the best at something, especially if you are, but you should be humble in light of that. You know, I'm a big believer in the eaters eat last thing, not literally at dinner, but when it comes to everything from bonuses to any of the, you know, difficult things. I'm a real believer in the fact that you, as a leader, you are responsible for everything that happens or fails to happen. You have to own that as a leader. Nobody likes a leader that makes excuses. You have to own it. If it's under your purview, it's on you. And then another thing too is, you know, give credit to the people on your team when things go right. Take the blame when things go wrong. And I think it's something that every good leader does, and it's something that I constantly remind myself of. And then ultimately too, I think maybe the last thing, just off the top of my head here, I could probably do an entire podcast on my opinions about leadership, but off the top of my head, the last thing that I'll say is recognize as a leader that you can be friendly, but you're not their friend. You're going to have to make hard decisions in the business world. You're going to have to fire people. You're going to have to fire people that you really like being around and that maybe actually are your friends in real life. I've had to do that before. You're going to have to make hard decisions. You're going to have to, do things that are not always extremely pleasant, but as a leader, you're not there just for the good times. You're there to, you know, really where you make your money is when you're there and keeping your cool and your composure and you're competent during times of crisis. And when the hard times have to be endured, you need to be enduring them at the forefront and setting the example for how to get through them. So those are kind of my quick, and I think those are as applicable to the business world as they are leading at any level in the military.
Marty, thank you so much for being a guest on the Spear. Looking forward to having you back up here at West Point, and good luck in all your current and future endeavors.
Thanks for having me on, Charlie. Rangers lead the way.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.